Thank you for moving forward. Much appreciated. We're going to go ahead and get started. Hello, my name is Marie Fisher. I'd like to welcome you to the Women on Wednesday series. Our theme this semester is Making an Impact, Women's Leadership and Community Organizing, which focuses on how women create positive change within their local and global communities. A few housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off all cell phones. Stay in your seats quietly until 12:50, and please be respectful of your neighbors. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, as we do use this information for future programming. And there are some upcoming events with more information on the back table, including RAD, which is a women's only self-defense training. Our topic today is titled, Telling Stories to Create Change. Women have always been in the forefront of making change, but often their leadership has not been recognized for the contributions they have made. It is important to note that feminism has been one way that this lack of acknowledgement has been brought to the attention of society. This session will use different stories to show how we can impact change in our communities by changing the status quo of unwritten rules that causes women's work and leadership to go unnoticed. It is hoped that young women will be inspired as well as empowered to take on the status quo in prudent and creative ways in order to bring about change. Our presenter today, Dr. Patience Togo, is an assistant professor here at SCSU in the social work department. She holds a BSW and MSW degrees from Carleton University in Canada and a PhD from the University of Minnesota. Her research interests include violence against women, anti-racist, anti-oppression pedagogy, multicultural education, community organizing, and parenting practices among African immigrants and refugees. We are very grateful to have her with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Dr. Patience Togo.
I'm very nervous because I see my colleagues here and they are really scaring me. All right, I really want to I'll first start here and then move around. I really want to use this opportunity to thank you all for actually coming. When I was approached to work on this, one of the things that kept coming to my head was, you know, there are so many things that I personally have experienced, and I'm sure most of you have experienced, that would be interesting to just take a look at. And the more I read the theme, I go, you know, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot, because as a young person growing up, I grew up in two worlds. Can you hear me? Okay. I grew up in two worlds. My first world was a home where I was just considered like anybody else. I grew up with four brothers, and you can imagine what the struggle is. I was the only girl. They hit me back and forth, and so I had to be tough to be able to survive in such a world, right? So that was my first world. I didn't know any different. I didn't even know I was a girl till I was 10, when my mom said, "You're different from your brother." And I go, "Why?" She said, "Well, because you're going to get boobs and you're going to do this, and your brothers wouldn't." So that's when I knew I was different. But then my other world was the world outside home, where I was always told that I was not, you know, up to the same as my brothers, or any boy child was better than I was. And so I started questioning. I said, why? Why is that? Because I can climb trees. I fought my brothers. A couple of times I beat them up. And I don't know why I would be considered any different than my brothers. But that was the world. And so, and then as a child, like I said, I started questioning a lot of the things that were happening around me. One of the critical things that I started seeing was that a lot of the things that women did, men took credit for. And I really did not understand that. Because, for example, in my home, my mom did the planning, where we went to school, what kind of clothes we wore, what kind of food we ate. But still, our dad was like the boss, or considered, we always thought of him as the boss. And I said, he doesn't cook, he doesn't clean, he doesn't take us even to our first, like, kindergarten that we went. Why is he taking all the credit for the things that our mom was doing? And I also saw that even in politics, okay, all the big political parties that would win would normally win only if they had the local market women support them. So Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, I'm sure most of you have heard about him. Kwame Nkrumah's party was no party without the women. But they took credit for it. You hear the names of, all the names that you hear were men. There was nothing mentioned about the women. And so, you know, this kind of surprised me a lot. When you look at our kinship, women were very important in the process. We even have a saying that if they get into like a big debate and they have to make important decisions, a statement is made like, let's go ask the old lady. But the old lady is always at the back. The old lady was never at the fore. The old lady was always at the back. So if the old lady agrees, then it means we are ready to go. And so I kept asking, why is that? You know, when we're gonna get married, if you have to get married, they always say we have to talk to the mother. If the mother agrees, then you're ready to go. I'm sure it's the same in this culture, right? But still, when time comes for the dowry, whatever we call it, it's given to the man. And so, you know, I kept asking, why is that? When we do death ceremonies, for example, when a person dies in my country, it's the woman who has to bathe the body. It's not the man. The first person that needs to see the body is the woman. But when it comes to the, when you look at the obituaries, they put all the men first. And so, you know, I keep asking, why is that? And so, I mean, these are just little examples of things that happens, and I'm pretty sure you can see it in your own lives here many times. And as young people, sometimes we think of change as somebody coming from the moon. You have to have a PhD. You have to be somebody big to effect change. But I'm here to tell you that you don't have to be big. There was this little girl who was always told that because she was a girl, she needs to look beautiful, right? And so, but then she needs to look beautiful for a man to marry her, but then she was always told that she needs to do all the house cleaning, do all the cooking. There's a specific dish in our country called the fufu. Anybody heard fufu before? Yeah. And it's hard labor. You have to pound to eat the food. So this little girl looked, analyzed the whole situation and said, geez, if I'm supposed to be beautiful for somebody to marry me, if you do that job, your palm become very thick. So she's not going to do it because she's not going to be beautiful for a man to marry if that's the deal. So she decided that's what she was going to do. And her father agreed that that's what she needs to do. And there is another story where, so this woman, this young girl, changed that culture, right? In her home or wherever it was, that everywhere you go, people, or it was only the girls or the women who pounded fufu. But this girl changed her world with that little thing, saying, I'm going to use, so she used the stereotype, right? to her advantage. So young girls, do that if you can. There is another, in our culture, when people pass away, instead of, we have like a celebration. And I remember very well, we had gathered to do the ceremony for this passing away. And one of the things that they usually would do during those processes is to cook a big feast. And so everybody was in a circle. And guess what? Who were in the back, at the back of the circle? All the women were at the back of the circle, and the men were, you know, they are like the chief mourners, they call them. There's never a woman chief mourner. And so, I mean, then the time came where they had to delegate people to do stuff. That's what they normally do. And so the delegates, they picked five men. Five men were picked. They are always a big boss. And then they said, okay, you guys are going to be in charge of food. And then the moment they said that, they were like, oh, yeah, so we're going to do that. Then they turned right away and asked their wives, how much does a bag of rice cost? I said, wait. Don't we choose leaders because we know they can do something for us? Right? Why are we choosing people who are going to be asking somebody else to do something? So I said, wait. Why do we have to? I mean, men, you can't do the job. You're asking your wives to do it. So why don't we give the leadership to the women to do their job? Because they know where the bag of rice costs. They know how much it costs. They know where to get it. They are even going to cook it. So why do we have to give it to the men, you know, and then it would be transferred to the women to do anyway? And there was a big uproar. Oh, and who is talking? A girl? You're not even supposed to be here. In the circle, you're supposed to be at the back. And I go, no, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. I mean, so we got into this big argument about why do we choose leaders? And so one old man said, you know, I think she got a point. I think she got a point. So what they did was they called the wives of the five men that they picked. And within 5 seconds, the women put together what was going to be cooked, where to get everything. I mean, 2 minutes, they did everything. And I know it would have taken us 10 years for those men to do anything. So from that point on, I had gone back maybe a couple months ago, and then an old lady called me aside and said, guess what? Now the tradition here in Adidome is that when somebody dies, it's women who are called upon to take charge of this whole process. And guess what? The process goes by quickly because you're not transferring responsibility from one person to the other. And it makes sense, right? And so as young people, I'm here again to tell you that, I mean, it was scary for me as a young little girl. And the story that I told you, first of all, it was me. I told my brothers I wasn't going to pound the fufu. So I still have my soft palm, thank God. They hated me for that, but I'm glad I did. I mean, if I were looking for like a big change, I was looking for somebody to come from heaven to make that change for me, it wasn't going to happen. So right now, in my little town, Adidome, they have this tradition that whether it's weddings, whether it's funerals, whether it's, whatever they're doing, they have to call the women to be the leaders to get this thing organized, because that's what women do. We got power as women. Sometimes we just don't know how much power we got. I mean, if you look at so many things around you, you've heard that thing behind every successful man. It's what? It's a woman. But we never get the credit. And I know as young people, sometimes we are scared. We don't know where to start. We don't know where to begin. We don't know where to end. We kind of feel like it's too much of a job for us to do, but it's not. You can do little things in your communities, very little things. You know, don't let anybody tell you that just because this is what the status quo is, it cannot be changed. I was constantly told, I mean, in my other world or my world, I was constantly told that a woman's place is the kitchen. So there's no need to educate a woman. Here I am. Thank God to my education, right? I was constantly told, why would you spend my money on the girl when you can spend money on the boys, right? You know, when you spend all the money, she's just going to go get married to somebody and be in her office, which is the kitchen. And I never did. I mean, I like cooking, but it's not my favorite place. It's not my favorite place. So don't let anybody tell you that the status quo is that you have to have children, you have to have this. No, there's nothing like that. We are just as capable as men. We can do anything that we put our minds to do. My last story that I would tell you is about a small community where one man really beat on his wife so terribly. He always beat on the wife. And nobody was doing anything. So all the women in the village got together and said, Kofi, this is what we are going to do. We are all coming to the agreement that we are not going to cook tonight. Because they do the cooking, right? So all the women gathered in one house. So nobody cooked. So every man came from the farm. There was no food. So what's going on? They said, well, Kofi beat up on his wife again. And guess what? All our wives are on strike. They're not going to cook. So the men go, my God, Kofi, we got to do something about this. Because I am not going to take your punishment, something that you have done, I'm not going to be responsible for that because I need my food. And so what they did was, Kofi, this is going to be you promising that from this day on, you're not going to hit your wife anymore. So that's how they were able to get Kofi to stop hitting his wife. Right? As simple as refusing. So you use the same tool, right? The same very tool that were given them as they were the cookers or chefs. That's the nice way of saying you're a slave. They use that to their advantage, to make change, right? And to make change, which is to stop Kofi from hitting his wife. So I don't know about you, but I know that you can do it. Small changes, like what the little girl did in her house, saying, well, if I'm going to be pretty for the man to marry me, I'm not going to do the hardcore cook fufu anymore. Or the young little girl who said, if the women are going to be making those purchases anyway, they should be the leaders, right? Or those village women who came together to say that, we are not going to take this anymore. We are going to take a stand, right? And make a change. I would actually end with a small poem that I wrote. And I know that I've shared stories about Ghana, but this is just to show that this is not any different anywhere. And the title of the poem is, And the Beat Goes On. The beat, I put it in quotes. the beats represent like drums in Africa. So it goes like this. We dance to culture's harsh tunes, designed and choreographed and executed by men, solely for women born to man. From the nooks and cranks of Abo or Alabama to the posh offices of Accra and the homes of the Zulus, our souls, dignity, and humanity march in steps to the soulless and degrading inhumanity. We move from the south to east or north to west, hoping for refuge and respite. But even in the beauty and glamour of Toronto, London, Paris, and New York, the filth of home clings to us as the frightening and dehumanizing beat goes on. Thank you. Any questions for me? You can't ask questions. No, I'm sorry. Okay. So my beautiful colleague is actually trying to ask, where did the courage for me came from for me to challenge the status quo? Is that right? Okay. Well, I guess for me, I would say it came from my grandmother and my mother. And also just from all the women that I saw around, because for like the little things that I saw in terms of even the politics, where women would be, you know, the people that would, you know, make people win. If you have more, the more women you have, the more and the better chances you have of winning. Women work very hard. And so for me, I would say it came from that experience. And then also from the fact that I was actually given a space to be able to question, because I mean, that was very unusual. I was actually seen as not a material, somebody who would never get married, because no man wants a woman like you. Even my brothers told me that thank God you are my sister, because I don't want a woman like you, you know, who would want to act like a man, you know? And for me, I said, well, maybe there will be a place for me where I can be me. And so I would say the courage came from all the women, you know, especially those close to me, as well as, you know, the larger women in the community that, you know, they were silenced. They didn't have the voices to say the things that I was saying. But maybe because I was a child too, you know, it gave me that courage. Because I mean, I don't know what is fear, you know, especially when you're old. Like, for example, I don't know how to swim because I never learned how to swim as a child. So I have developed that fear of swimming. But if I hadn't, maybe I would have done it. So, you know, maybe I haven't developed that yet. So I just tried it and it worked. Thank you. Any other question? Go ahead. Storytelling, I mean, in African setting, even if your parents wants to discipline you, they use a story to tell you why you have to, you know, do what you, why they have to do what you have to do. So storytelling was always around me. And it's very interesting that you bring that up, because the older I got, and the more I listened to the stories that were told, it was very clear that the work of a woman was clearly even decided for us in the stories, because we have like that Nancy stories. Anybody heard about that Nancy stories? Those are the big characters in the African, you know, storytelling. And the Anansi is like a man, he's the spider. Anansi is a spider. And he gets all the credit for all the work that his wife would do. And so, I would say even the stories were used to, to confirm why, as a girl, you're not supposed to be educated. As a girl, why you're not supposed to challenge, you know, because we are always told. I mean, the storytelling is like a part of our fabric. It's woven into everything that we do, you know, whether you go into school, whether you're going to get married, whether you die and you're being buried, everything is about storytelling. And so for me, that's how I understood the world. And then I had my own interpretation. Said, geez, you know, what if those characters were women? Would the story end differently? I bet it would. So it really was, storytelling was really one way of me really understanding what was happening around me at the time.
Do you incorporate it in your current teaching practice?
Definitely. I see some of my students here, I always use myself. I'm always in, you know, because I strongly believe that we are what we present, right? And I can't separate me from what I do. And if I really want you to get what I'm trying to say, maybe if you're able to see me, you know, cry, feel, you know, then you would most likely understand what I'm trying to tell you. So I use a lot of storytelling. They've heard a lot about my kid, who thinks she's my mother, a lot. And I see a lot, you know, of that questioning and stuff in her too, which I'm glad that she's doing. Any other question? That's actually what the poem that I just wrote was actually written when I did my master's dissertation thesis. And there's all the stories that I heard about from the women. And I was doing something on domestic violence in the Ghanaian community. And this is not something that we talk about. But once again, me being the curious patient that I was, I decided to do that. And It was very clear to me that even though, you know, we come to different places, like the poem said, we move to places like, you know, New York, London, Paris, whatever we have at home still carries, comes along with us. And so the women are really challenged, you know, with wanting to be the good wife. Because one thing, though, is that when we, in our culture, for example, if you get married, you're not just marrying your husband or your wife. You're marrying the whole community. So you divorce, you're going to divorce the whole community. So most of the time, women would stay in the relationship because they would say they want to be able to go back into their community. I met with a woman who was really experiencing a lot of violence in her relationship, but then could not say anything Because even when she confides in people and she tells them, they would say, well, but you can't call the police. But you can't destroy the family. And even she was getting calls from home that you can't do this. I mean, I want to be able to, you know, I'm in the same choir with your husband, your mother-in-law. So you can't do that. And so she got the courage to say enough is enough. And she left. But then she was ostracized from the community. And nobody would talk to her. And so she was actually in the U.S. and moved to Canada quietly. And nobody knew what her life was. But then for some reason, when I was talking to her, you know, I was telling her what I wanted to do, then she, you know, said, you know, I would love to tell my story. So I see a lot, there are so many stories out there that are untold. Most of these people are silent because of the challenges that they have to face. Because trust me, this culture also, you know, I'm sure when you go somewhere and you say you're from Africa, we see you as, oh, you're oppressed, you're this. No, it's not necessarily true. Women challenged. I was like it, and my mother was. I know so many women who were not your typical Ghanaian woman. You know, they challenged the status quo all the time. And women continue to do that here too. But the challenge is, you know, trying to keep with your culture and, you know, also, you know, just maintain your sanity, I call them. But one thing that I always say, abuse in any language is abuse. It's wrong. No culture has, you know, there's nothing in any culture that says that you can do this to one person. We only interpret it to, you know, fit whatever we want to do. But it's really not, you know, the case. And so there are so many people, or refugee and, you know, women here who are really struggling with that, finding the space. One big thing, though, that I found was finding a name for what is happening. Okay? The language is very different. In my research, women would use the word, he disciplines me, instead of he hits me. Or, you know. So when you think of discipline, it's very different from, you know, hit, right? And so, you know, the way, and there is no word in our, in Ghana we have about 47 different dialects. I call them languages. And none of those languages had a word for rape. So if this happens to you, how do you explain to, I'm in social work, so how do you tell your counselor that, you know, my partner raped me? You can't say that because there's no word. So they will go and say, well, he disciplines me. Well, if you say somebody disciplines you, meaning you've done something wrong, right, then you are being corrected. So it's very different. So that's a big challenge. So now I think the most important thing, or the most one thing that I do when I talk to people is to find a name for what is happening. If you're able to name it, because I think feminism, that was one big thing that feminism did for us, by naming, you know, the experiences that women have, so that women are able to tell from right and wrong. I don't know if that... Any other question? You have a question? I'm trying to pick one.
If a woman encountered a situation of rape or abuse and she decides to leave, is she alone? Is there support for them outside their communities? What do they
do? Usually you are alone. Because what is usually happening is, you know, the family sees that as a shame. You are, and even, you know, sometimes people use, and even here they use marriage as a form to abuse, because we want to be married, right? It's a big thing to be married. It's a prestige to be married, right? So the man will say, if you don't do what I'm going to divorce you, which will make you feel yicky, right? So you stay. And so if a rape, for example, what the example that you're given happens, you are alone. Who do you talk to? Who is going to believe you? And I'm sure it's the same here, where especially if you're married to the person. How do you explain that somebody that you're married to raped you? Because you're supposed to do that with them anyways, right? So it's hard. It's very hard. And even people who will support you wouldn't want to be seen that they are supporting you, because it would mean that they are condoning what you're doing, which is leaving the relationship. So it's very hard. But that is not to say people are not doing it. People take the courage all the time to say, I'm not going to do this. And that's the change that we need. That's the change that we need, that it is okay to be unattached. It's great to be attached, but it's also very okay if that makes you happy not to be, because nobody deserves to be attached and be abused, regardless. So that's the change we need. We need people to say, yes, I'm going to hurt my family if I leave this man or this woman, but I will do it, because that's the change I need for me. The hero is nobody. It's you. The hero lies in ourselves. Nobody else is our hero. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Any other question?
How is your relationship with your brothers now? I mean, are they proud of you?
Oh, very proud. I boss them a lot. And I'm glad. This summer, actually, I had the opportunity to meet with two of them, two in Europe. And I was spoiled rotten. And they would always say, oh, my sister, she doesn't take no nonsense from anybody. You know, they're very proud of me. And so, we would talk about some of the little stuff. And they said, well, I guess because you really did a lot of the challenging, that's why you are where you are right now. Because if I had just said, well, I'm the girl and I'm not supposed to do this and I'm not supposed to do that, then I wouldn't do anything, right? So they are very proud of me, yeah.
Can I get on to that? So they're really proud of you as a sister, but a while ago they wouldn't want to marry you.
No. They still don't want to marry me, though. No, they still don't want to marry me. That's very true. They don't even want me to know their girlfriends. I would know them, but don't get too close.
Okay. Because you're too strong.
Too, yeah, no.
Is that why?
Yes. It's good, you know. It's like having your sister's kids, knowing very well they can go. They'll go back to their parents, but you don't have to be with them like 24/7. So, yeah. It's only one brother who has a daughter. And ironically, he wants his daughter to be like me. She's even named after me. So if she's not, you gotta be like your auntie. Because he knows, right, that it will be beneficial for him, for his daughter to be strong. But he doesn't want his wife to be strong. And you know why. There's so many names for me. You're a man, you're white. you're really not, how do I say it? You're not a marrying type, because I don't want to take you home to my mother, because you won't cook. I like to cook. But that's not my favorite hobby. I tell them all that when I was coming from my mother's womb, I didn't bring the pots and pans and say, geez, I'm a chef. No. I know how to cook. But that if that's the reason why. And even when I was a young person dating people, when I bring somebody home, the first thing my mom would ask, do you cook? You say, why? She said, well, because my daughter, she doesn't cook. So you can imagine I got a few dates, right? Because nobody wants to. But, I mean, in a sense, they're proud. They're proud, you know, to have, you know, somebody, you know, excel. But one part is no, but still be, you know, I've heard somebody say to me that, you know, you're very unusual. You are able to balance home and, like, work, because I can still do be the domestic type, and I can still be the office type, which is kind of funny. I don't want to be. I mean, I do it because I want to do it, but I don't like it when it's pointed out to me. So yeah, they're proud, but still, you know, people wouldn't want you too close to their fiancés, because you're gonna pull it their head. Any other questions? I have a daughter.
Okay. Yeah. And through your own experiences, how do you translate that into teaching her how to stand up for herself and be strong in certain things?
Okay. One of the things that I did as when she was very young is to not make excuses for her. Give her the opportunity to, I would always say, convince me why you should do this and not that. Because I don't always think I am right. Most of the time I think I am, but I also want her to be herself, because I truly believe that will be very helpful for her. Because as a young child, I worked very hard to not let people just tell me what to do, and so I really try very hard not to tell her what to do. You know. Sometimes I say, you can't do this because, and I tell her, one of the things that I always tell her is that, she's 15, is that if you go out on a first date with somebody and they say, you know, what is your favorite dish that you make, drop them. Because then the expectation is that that's what you're going to be doing. I want you to find out what I like. I mean, what other stuff do I do other than kitchen stuff? If they ask you, drop them. So, I mean, I really want her, or I try to let her ask questions. Don't just do this because I'm asking you to do that. And, you know, I try to give her that, I hope, you know, and live my life so that it scares me that she will say I'm her role model. Because I said, gee, maybe it's not going to be that great for you. Because you always be butting heads with people. You don't want to do that. But I try. Because I think it's important for me for her to ask questions and challenge, you know, stuff. Because I tell her, don't let anybody tell you that you can't be this, you can't be that. You can be whatever you want to be. So far as you put your head to it. So we had, when she was little, there was this little saying in my house. And even when I say I can't, she said, Mommy, don't say you can't. Say I'll try. Any other question?
So if anyone wants to come up and ask patients questions afterwards, please feel free to do so. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I made it.
Thank you for coming.
What's your favorite thing to cook?
You're dropped. Thank you. Oh, sorry.